Chapter 5. Depression. Jens, aged 55. Jens is 55 years old and single. He has never been married, has no children, and does not have a large family, nor does he have many friends. At home, in his apartment, he often feels lonely. By contrast, his work life is functioning well. He's industrious at his job, and his employer is fond of him, because he's always ready to take on extra work. He's also always the one who stays a bit longer if a task needs to be finished because there's no one waiting for him at home. Work is his only constant. For many years, he has suffered from mild depression, and one year before I met him for the first time, he had been hospitalized for several months in a psychiatric ward with severe depression. In the psychiatric ward, the doctors tried to medicate him several times, but nothing within classical medicine had helped him. He's a person you immediately feel sorry for because of his sad and melancholy nature. Whenever I meet a client who, like Jens, has lost hope, I remind myself that I must not delve into the client's hopelessness. Doing so may be humanly understandable, but professionally it is completely wrong. Because as a therapist, you should not delve into the client's CAS and be there with them. Their CAS must be reduced as quickly as possible and eventually eliminated. After the latest long hospitalization, Jens now fears that he will end up in the psychiatric ward again because he has started to feel ill again. He's about to give up any hope of getting better. The apartment that he lives in is dreadfully messy. The cupboards are broken, and he does not have the energy to repair them. The walls need painting, and overall, it is very dirty. I ask him why he does not do anything about it, and he answers that it all seems too overwhelming whenever he comes home from work, and he does not know where to start. "I can't invite anyone home because it looks so awful," he tells me, and on the other hand, "Who should I invite? Is there any reason at all to do anything about this apartment?" The trigger thought. Jens's typical trigger thoughts are, "Why do I have to be here at all? It doesn't make any sense for me to be in this life." These are the thoughts that trigger his daily ruminations about the futility of life. The many hours of rumination affect his emotions. And Jens becomes more and more depressed and has even less desire to do something good for himself. These thoughts force him into a passive state. He simply does not have time to do anything active because he is so busy being occupied by his thoughts. It is not my opinion that he is close to suicide, but in any case, life is sad when you spend many hours every day trying to find an answer as to why you exist in the first place. My experience is that it does no good for me to confirm his view that he has a miserable life because he already knows this. What he does not know is how he can deal with it in a more constructive way. Outward or inward focus. At work, everything is fine, as long as he stays on task and does not have time to ruminate. But as soon as he is on his way home, his focus shifts from his work to himself. When I, together with Jens, link his states of inward and outward focus with the states of mind he finds himself in, gradually a clear picture begins to emerge that his excessive inward focus is making Jens depressed. On the other hand, his mood improves when he directs his attention toward his surroundings. "When is it easiest to be you?" I ask him. "When are you emotionally neutral? Or when are you sad?" His answer is that it is naturally easiest to be him in the neutral state. The neutral state is also the most normal mental state for a person to be in. We can swing up and down, but the level in between is where we should be most often. At this point, it begins to make sense to Jens. He has had the sense that outward focus gives him the best state of mind, but he has not gotten help to put this into words before. 18,000 hours of rumination. It can be an eye-opener to see how much time is spent thinking heavy thoughts. Therefore, I get out a calculator and add up how many hours, days, weeks, months, and years of ruminating have been going on. For example, if Jens has spent approximately 5 hours a day over the past 10 years ruminating over his own unsatisfying life, it corresponds to about 18,000 hours. Such a concrete figure can have an overwhelming effect on a client. Nonetheless, it is important to see this number, because when people are as depressed as Jens is, they typically experience ruminating as a part of the solution, not as a part of the problem. People think that they have to find answers and solutions through overthinking. Also see Wells, 2009, Chapter 9. Now, you've spent 18,000 hours ruminating. Do you understand your thoughts now, and have you found a solution? I ask Jens. And yes, he tells me that he has in fact found some answers. But is this enough that you no longer need to think so much about what makes you sad? No, I've not found the answer to everything, Jens says, but I have to understand what is happening. Yes, but you have used 18,000 hours not finding any useful answers, I tell him. Will you ever find those answers? But maybe it's something biological, he answers. If it's biological, what else is there to think about? Does it make things any better when you think about them so much? No, it doesn't. How do you think you would feel if you thought less about your situation? Then I think I would feel better, he says. Control over your own thought processes. For Jens to feel better, he first needs to understand that he has an influence on what he does with his thoughts. Imagine a volume control where you can turn up or down the thoughts we've been talking about. Could you theoretically imagine that you could turn up the volume of your ruminating so that you spend even more hours on this? I ask Jens. And yes, he believes that he easily can. Can you imagine then that it's theoretically possible to turn down the ruminating too? Jens hesitantly agrees that this also might be possible. The task then is to find the switch that Jens, or any other client, needs to use to turn down this type of thought process. That Jens has the experience of having some control over his mind is crucial. He and every other client I work with should leave the room after their first session with me with a budding sense that they can influence their own thinking, not control over life, the past or future, but over their thinking itself. Wells, 1997, 2009. Refer, do not reject. Jens's CAS, the excessive inward focus, drags him down into a depression that becomes worse and worse. My solution is that he should first minimize the time he spends ruminating. If we can reduce the amount of time that is spent ruminating, as we psychologists call it, there will be time and energy to do something different and more constructive. 1 hour of ruminating a day instead of 5 hours. Jens finds this hard to believe, but I give him some postponement exercises where he is instructed to postpone the trigger or cast thoughts just as soon as he becomes aware of them. The task is not to dismiss or suppress his ruminations, but to relegate them to a later time that he has planned in advance. He must say to the thought, I can see that you are here. I will take care of you, but not until 8 p.m. tonight. He should do this every time cash-related thoughts come up. So 8 p.m. is therefore open, and if there are still negative thoughts, he is ready to face them. From Wells, 2009, pages 106 to 108. Be your own shopkeeper from 8 to 8:15 p.m. All thoughts are welcome during this time. If thoughts come knocking on your door after 8:15 p.m., you're closed. And then they will have to come back the next time the shop is open. And if there are no negative thoughts at 8 p.m, you just close early, I tell him. Just like when I go out into the waiting room to see if there are any more clients. If there is no one sitting and waiting, I close my door again. The key thing here is that it is not a stop strategy, which is about suppressing thoughts. This strategy is about postponing them. For Jens to understand the point of postponing a trigger or rumination and why it works, I tell him to imagine that a good friend calls him one day at work. Your friend is not feeling well and needs to talk things through with you. But you can't talk because you're sitting in an open office and have to do your job. And, of course, you can't share this serious conversation with your colleagues beside you. You can either tell your friend that you can't talk with him and hang up, or you can tell him that he is most welcome to call back tonight at 8 p.m. He will better understand the latter suggestion because you're not turning him down. It's the same with thoughts. Give them a specific time when they can be there and use the time that becomes available to do something practical. Do the dishes after you've eaten. If you have clothes to wash, go to the laundry room. I can't guarantee that you'll feel better, but what you've done so far has not worked. So try this until we see one another next time, and then we'll see whether this has worked. Already the next time we meet, Jens is feeling better. It has surprised him that he actually has a choice. Up until now, he has not been aware of this. But now he can see the value in facing the negative thoughts and deciding for himself when to tackle them. Symptom relief. Jens has a total of 5 therapy sessions with me. That is it. After having been hospitalized with severe depression and having been treated repeatedly over the last several years, he can cope with his own situation after such a short time. His CAS has been minimized. It's the first time in 20 years that he has realized that he does not need to be sad most of the time. Jens's journey does not stop after the 5 sessions. The aim of metacognitive therapy initially is to achieve symptom relief and pull him out of his depression. It is the same thing that happens if a patient has a fever of 40 degrees centigrade. It is a symptom of something else, but you have to begin by knocking the fever down and then concentrate on the cause of the symptom. For Jens, the next task will be to look at his values, choices, and relationships. In other words, he needs to start acting. For although he finds that he's no longer depressed, he also clearly expresses that he feels neither happy nor joyful. You cannot ruminate your way to answers. It is in meeting Jens and others in similar situations that the big difference between different forms of therapy and metacognitive therapy becomes apparent. For example, if a client has been to a psychodynamic therapist, they would have talked about his childhood or other events from the past, getting very close to the content of the client's life. They would have moved to the object level as opposed to the meta level. At the object level, they would have gone into the thoughts and talked about his relationship with his parents, for example. At the meta level, we talk about thoughts about feelings. This is also what I say to Jens. We should not talk about the content. And it is important to say this, because in previous forms of therapy, we have learned that thoughts are important. In metacognitive therapy, the content of the thoughts does not matter. It is what we do with the thoughts that matters. For me, it is more respectful that I do not try to go into the client's head and tell him what to think. I cannot be the arbiter of people's thoughts. As a human being, I believe in an individual's freedom to choose, including the freedom to choose their own thoughts. However, if I can show the client what happens when he's being overly aware of certain thoughts, he can make his own choices. I do not have to do this for him. Let us for a moment look at what happens when you go to therapy. You naturally focus inwards. Many have the perception that it is difficult to go to therapy. And I also do too, because of course it is difficult to sit for an hour with a person who is scratching at your innermost emotional life. It is not odd that you feel bad. In my courses for psychologists and other professionals, I sometimes use these examples. Imagine that right now we are going to spend an hour going through all your failures, the most embarrassing and horrible stories from your lives. How do you think that you will feel afterwards? Or think for a moment about the worst thing you have ever done and that you would rather take with you to the grave. Afterwards, tell your secrets to the person sitting next to you. I stop the course participants before they begin doing what I've asked them to do. But this is in fact the same thing we ask of our clients when we want them to tell us the details of their lives and thoughts. But why do we need to know the details of their lives at all? These are irrelevant in relation to the help we can give to them. For many years, there has been the understanding that it has to hurt in order to get better. But is this necessary? I do not think that this is always the case. Jens has a number of existential questions. Who am I? Why do I exist? Why must I be here? But I cannot help him with the answers. And therefore, it does not make sense to enter into a dialogue or to focus on the content of his thoughts. I am convinced that neither Jens nor anyone else can mull over all of the answers that they might want to find. Often, the answers cannot be found in our heads at all. Tools. Thought postponement. What can we do with the thoughts that we do not want to spend any more time on than is necessary? Instead of suppressing or rejecting these thoughts, we can defer them to a later time. When a worry arises, we can acknowledge that it is there instead of trying to escape it. Then we can defer it to a later time of our own choosing. For example, we can have an opening time, just as in Jens's case. Or we can give ourselves an intensive 15 minutes of ruminating time to which we refer our rumination and worries. This time can be whenever it fits into our daily lives. It is the time when rumination is welcome to be there. If we forget, the rumination or worries are perhaps not so relevant after all. And the next day, we will have the opportunity again. We can also refer our thoughts to when or if they become relevant. Many of our concerns are thoughts about what might happen in a possible future. What if? It is a future that we cannot foresee. We may worry about our children start having to go to school or cross a busy street by themselves. We can postpone this worrying until our children are old enough that they can walk by themselves and stop worrying while they're still toddlers. We may also be waiting for the answer from a medical test, and we know that the answer will first come in 14 days. So, we postpone worrying about the result until that date. Our concern is irrelevant when we do not know the result, and this thought has therefore shown up too early. If we need to be able to place the thoughts visually, we can imagine a waiting room where these thoughts can be allowed to wait their turn. The aim is to let go of these thoughts and not allow them to linger in our minds. Rumination is not something we need to remember. The thoughts themselves must come on time if they are important enough. We do not reject them. We just refer them. Turn it up and stop. We can turn up the volume of our worrying thoughts, but we can also turn the volume down. Let us imagine that we are standing at a busy train station waiting for a train. Thoughts and feelings are the trains passing through the station. We can choose to hop onto the worry train, but we can also choose to remain standing on the platform and just observe the trains going to and from the station. From our consciousness, we can conjure up a worry thought. Once we have found it, we should start worrying from this thought and ask ourselves all the questions we usually ask. What if? After a while, we should stop the worrying process by getting off the worry train again. That is, we should just get off at our mental train station and observe the thoughts that show up without doing anything about them. Then we do the same thing again. We climb on board the worry train and start the worrying process. And after a while, we get off again, observing the trigger thoughts and any other worry thoughts. It is possible for us to hop off and on the worry train. Most people will be able to feel a difference in their body and mind when they hop off the train just to observe their thoughts. We cannot lose control of ourselves and our minds no matter how much we worry. Our worry thoughts can never take control. When we climb off and on the worry train, and when we choose to move away from worry thoughts, it is because we have chosen to do so. We should therefore have to decide not to climb onto the worry train just because it has arrived at the platform. When we climb on board the train, it should be because we have decided to do so. And then we should only be there for the time we've set aside for it, whether it's an hour or 15 minutes. This exercise is based freely on Wells, 2007, 2009.